Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Hello and welcome to the Fan Experience Experience, the podcast that explores the power of engagement in football and other sports. Join me, Mark Bradley, and my co-pilot, Darren Young, as our guests tell us their stories and share what they've learned. In season two of this podcast, we're exploring fan engagement post-COVID, and we're uncovering from the experience of our guests new ideas to help your club, league, or association to prosper amidst all of this uncertainty as we emerge from the pandemic. So Darren, it's been an interesting week for Walsall as we record this podcast, has it not?
Well, just the little matter of losing a manager completely out of the blue. Nothing out of the ordinary.
Well, it's only, of course, we spend weeks haranguing them and making their lives misery, so at least they know it's happening, you know, when the day comes. But at Walsall, you like to do things differently, don't you?
Well, I was in the car, and then I just heard this almost like last part of the sports bulletin that just said, oh yeah, and Port Vale have announced a manager, and I thought, I know that name, I'm sure he's our manager. apparently not anymore. So, you know, we're at the start of another project, let's say.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, you might be Frank Lampard's Walsall. You never know. But anyway,
who knows?
We're moving on to, in this episode, we're talking to someone we both know, Jeff Hutton, who's the general manager at Bromley FC. And I've met Jeff in situ on a couple of occasions, both on a non-match day and a match day, and always been impressed with just the look and feel of the place, the plans that they've got, the fact that they go ahead implementing the plans. And it's just, in fact, it was Hartlepool, if you remember. Jeff, hello, nice to see you.
Hi, everyone, cut you up.
Yeah, we're very well. It was Hartlepool, wasn't it, the visitors at the very first game that we took in? I seem to remember that.
And I think it was.
I think it was a solid 2-0 victory as well. It might have even been 3-0. But you first fell for the club, it says here, in 2004. And, you know, from then you've spent time volunteering at the club. You're currently now, you know, general manager. So you're effectively running the club on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, Darren and I are always interested in getting an insight into the, you know, to how it actually works. And we thought, you know, we've got some good questions for you. But start us off. Tell us how and why you fell for the club and you started getting involved.
Yeah, I think probably my dad was a Leeds United fan. Didn't work out well considering we were living in just outside of Bromley in Croydon at the time. So didn't get up to Elland Road that often. And it was my younger brother who came to his first Bromley game. Yeah, like you say, must have been around 2004, 2005. And yeah, I think at the time, our little, what was it, £5 or £10 pocket money got us into the game, got us a burger, got us a program, managed to play a game of pool, still had money left. And yeah, it was a great way to spend a Saturday or spend a Tuesday evening. So yeah, just felt so close to the action, you know, from watching it on TV or something like that to actually being literally on the side of the pitch up against the fence. Seeing the players, you know, in a bar afterwards, coming out of the dressing rooms and having that sort of access and feel. And yeah, from watching our first game, I don't think we missed a game since after that. Probably in the, what, 15 or 16 years, there's probably a dozen or so games that we've not been to. And yeah, just was made to feel so welcoming by everybody. Just had a real... I don't know, a real hominess about it. There was, yeah, I think probably 410, I think, was probably the amount of people the first game, first season.
When you're talking, it's reminding me of, you mentioned pool table, and when Darren and I talk about the fan experience, you know, clear, a lot of people, you know, still think it's the 90 minutes, you know, that you sit down, the game starts, you stand up, you follow the action, and then you go home afterwards. And, you know, things like a pool table make all that difference, because you can say to your friend, should we go to the game? And they think, I don't want to see a football match. You know, I'll watch it on telly or I'll do something else. And then you say, well, can I have a game of pool? And most people's perceptions of football is that you wouldn't have a game of pool at the football.
No, exactly.
Yeah, but when Luis and I were doing a program for Neil Doncaster up in Scotland, we're going back 8 years now. It was actually his the week of his 18th birthday. We went up to Berwick, see Berwick Rangers play. And they have, obviously, a very windswept, and believe me, you know, don't believe the rubbish you hear from West Brom and Oldham, and, you know, about being cold grounds. You want to try being at Berwick's ground. And they have a wonderful social club, which I wasn't aware of at all, where we were playing pool before the game. You know, so it's kind of, I mean, you'd agree, Darren, wouldn't you, that the idea of doing other things is a really key part of a club's growth plan, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We learned, I mean, I think during the first season of the podcast, we sort of heard so many examples where people were doing things or trying to do things that were outside of the 90 minutes and the difference that made. So, yeah, it's such a big part of it. But Jeff, I mean, we've had on the podcast now lots of people who've sort of told us their experiences, but I'm not sure we've had many people who've been able to tell us what it's like to run a club literally in the middle of a pandemic. So I'm interested in how that's been.
Challenging is the probably the one word to sum it up, the fairest word. We're incredibly fortunate to have an owner, board of directors, but specifically the owner, Robin Stanton-Gleaves, our chairman, who's been fantastic throughout this whole period, from right back at the start of March, with regards to supporting our players and keeping everybody together and sort of employed, as it were, basically. But in the 15 years of being involved at a football club, and certainly the last 5 or 6 as general manager, much like anybody else in the industry, I'm sure no one's ever experienced anything like this. And I think you've seen how clubs deal with it. I think certain clubs have done fantastically well. There are examples in our league, right back when the league was sort of called off in March, April, where, you know, basically just announced straight away that everybody was being made redundant, and they didn't even take a moment to pause and take a breath and sort of evaluate where we are. And whether it's, you know, a lot of it's come from Robin, our chairman, with regards to the direction, but we have been afforded the opportunity to take our time and try and evaluate things and really try and plot a course through this, which has completely been unpredictable and has taken twists and turns all over the place. But we've definitely been fortunate enough here to have the support from above to just take our time and try and make the correct decisions, not just short term but also long term, whether that's been on the fan engagement side and liaising with fans, or whether that's been on our own internal, supporting our staff, supporting our players through it all.
That was going to be a question I was going to ask you next, Jeff, about the players. It's always one of those things where you wonder how the players are dealing with this, because it must be such a strange, strange thing for them to go through. You know, not just playing without fans, which is strange enough in itself, but the whole everything that goes on in between matches as well.
100%. I think we've got to a great point with our squad, and we've been really fortunate. Neil Smith, our manager, has always signed very good players, but he's also signed very good people. We've got a real team spirit off the field amongst everybody, and that really sort of come to the fore during the sort of 6 months before the pandemic, where our community scheme had really picked off. We were in schools every other day of the week. The players were all of a sudden, you know, we talk about players as role models to youngsters, etc., and sometimes the players don't see that themselves, but they were getting that first-hand experience. They were seeing it themselves. They were walking into assemblies with school kids looking up to them, and we felt like we were in a really good place. And obviously then the pandemic hit, and all of a sudden we're all on Zoom calls, and we're remotely connecting, trying to connect with players and keep them engaged. And I must say, Neil Smith, Mark Hammond, Ben May, and Alan Dunn, the whole first team management done a fantastic job in keeping everybody connected. And, you know, we were communicating the best that we could at the time. We were the same as everybody else. We didn't really have all the information to hand, but yeah, the players just went above and beyond, both in terms of keeping themselves fit and active throughout the whole period. You know, in the end, for no reason, because we never did get back playing, but also in terms of what they gave us in terms of keeping our fans engaged and communicating with supporters and playing an active part in any kind of initiative or idea that we came up with. And we were able to turn some ideas around really quickly and, yeah, just make sure that we're all still playing our part with our fans and our community. And, yeah, just very, very fortunate that we've got a good group of people here.
We've always seen, I know there are different definitions of engagement and sustainable growth, but I think everybody would agree a key element of it is being close to the supporter community. And obviously this has never been more important than over these last few months. So you touched on in that answer to Darren's last question on a couple of things that you've done, how the players have got involved in supporter communication. Can you give us a few examples of some of the things you did? And then what I'm then going to actually try and move on to is, how do you think this places you now as you kind of, you know, looking forward to a point when fans might be coming back?
A lot of the ideas centered around, originally they were quite similar to most of clubs, I suppose. We found out that the games were off. We'd probably have had food stock for the next 2-3 home games, all sitting, you know, going to waste, as it were. And so one of the first things was, okay, we've got this, how do we make use of it? Whether it was donations to the food banks, Matt in our community scheme set up a community care support line, which you know, sounds wonderfully technical, etc. But actually, it was just a case of the three of us all sitting by our phones, basically with a job of doing whatever the caller needed, really. So we reached out to our season ticket holders. I think it really highlighted on our side. We've continuously learned throughout this whole process, but it really highlighted the, you know, how much communication do we have? How much contact do we have with certain elements of our season ticket holders and our loyal fan base on a regular basis? And social media is very often a sort of quick shortcut. Okay, yeah, we've put something out, we've communicated, we've shared. But actually, when we looked at our season ticket holders and a third of them were over the age of 65, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you're rocket science to work out how many of them are actually on the internet and connected. So we made a conscious decision straight away to prioritise them, make sure we gave them all a phone call from us. And because, you know, it sort of happened really quickly, didn't it, with regards to the lockdown. So even in terms of getting things like bread and milk and eggs, you know, I remember there being all sorts of issues around that. So we were in a fortunate position having prepared for the upcoming home games. And yeah, we turned into a bit of a shopping delivery service for the first couple of weeks. But I just... How well that went down and how well that was received. And I think we probably underestimated, for us it just seemed like the right thing to do. It was something that we could do because there wasn't a lot that we could do during the period, of all due respect. You know, the players weren't necessarily with us. Yeah. So that blew us away, because I think we saw it as quite a simple gesture, more almost a practical exercise for where we were. But actually, very quickly we realised, you know, it went down a lot further than that, and we had the sort of sons and daughters of those the sort of more elderly fan base that we'd called and offered our services for, even if they didn't need any help, they didn't need anything for us, just were grateful to have a conversation about the club for 20 minutes on the phone.
And, you know, what's really interesting about that, and I'm sure Darren's got a few more questions to ask too, but what's really interesting about that is that they say that a person or an organization's values are best tested in a crisis. And one of the things that, you know, Darren and I talk a lot about is football's kind of underappreciation of the power of club identity. You know, so fundamentally a club exists to, you know, pursue sporting glory. I think we all agree that, but because of the emotional connection between a club and its followers, it runs much deeper than that. And as we've talked about before, in order to, you know, build and extend a club's reach, especially a community club like Bromley, and to diversify the groups of people coming along and to grow the club, it needs to stand for something a little bit more than just trying to win football matches. So do you think you've uncovered something a bit about the natural identity of the club in this exercise?
Definitely. I think it's, like you say, the most important thing for us has always been to grow and develop and be able to play a part in our community, but mean something to, as much as when I first walked in the door 15 years ago, and for whatever reason, I had that ultimate connection, fell in love with the place. You're trying to go back and go, what were the reasons? Why did I? Why can't more people, you know, how do you grow that? How do you get more people to have that same amount of passion and same amount of care for the football club as you? And I think it naturally comes across if you've got the people inside the organisation have that level of care anyway, and we're very fortunate here with that. But also, you know, the drive from the directors to grow this club and grow our participation in the community has been key, because the investments they've made haven't. Of course, we've invested on the playing field, and we've had some good years and we've had some bad seasons. But the investment off the field, with regards to our 3G pitches and our community facilities, you know, has excelled that process, where we've gone from probably 15 years ago from having four youth teams, predominantly, or they were all boys teams from under 12s to under 18s. We've now got 55 teams across the entire club, and that stretches from under sixes all the way through to our academy programme, boys and girls in the academy and at youth level. We've got an over 30s women's recreational team. We've got a pan-disability football team. Just before the pandemic, we're at the point of launching the walking football. And it's just, we were plugging into all of the right things. We'd found a way to really get across and play our part in the community for so many different demographics, rather than just the usual football fan Saturday, Tuesday, brilliant. We have a real sense of community, and that old community centre, that old, you say, the social club element, that whole vibe, that energy, that's sort of what we're trying to create at Hayes Lane, and the facilities have aided that massively, and we've still got stuff going on at the moment in our stand, which is only going to excel that. And then when the pandemic hit, and obviously we were doing what we were doing, and because we had already such good sort of communication links and were embedded with so many parts of our community, it made the task a lot easier with regards to identifying who maybe needed the help and where we could help best, and where we were maybe more suited to help than other organisations. So everybody was doing their utmost to help at that time. But it was amazing. It was sort of it was a marker of just how far we've come, and actually, you know, what we're doing is working.
I mean, you mentioned the fans a lot, and I just wondered what was coming back to you the other way from the fans. What are they saying about what's happened, and also, have they give you any clues on what their behaviours and attitudes are likely to be after the pandemic?
We remember having so many Zoom calls with directors and the owner, and to be honest, the fans are fantastic. I think they really appreciated what we'd done. Like I said, the messages that we were getting back from, you know, people, we dropped off like a dozen eggs to somebody, and a photo was put up on social media, and it was shared viral, and there were other people, you know, saying, "I wish my club did things like that." And the little things like that were like, we've literally just dropped a dozen eggs around to a gentleman who needed them, you know, and it was sort of, that gave us a bit of perspective on the whole, I think. But and in those early days, it was, when are we next playing football? When can I buy my season ticket for next year? And it was, so you had this strange, and again, maybe that came because we were doing, maybe part of that was because we were doing the right things off the field, and people could see that we were trying to do the right things. And I think a lot of supporters certainly did want to, not maybe reward their club, but also give us something back. You know, a lot of people wanting to buy tickets, wanting to buy, even though we couldn't tell them when the next game was, or promise them that next season they'd be allowed in. And again, I think we made a really brave and big call there. And again, credit to the chairman. We didn't take their money. We didn't sell season tickets for this year. We didn't. And again, it's not a criticism of any other club, because everybody's in their own unique situations. But we were very fortunate to have the owner and group of directors that we do that made that possible. You'd like to think that that's all gone down well with our fellow fans. And I think it has. Time will always tell, obviously, but we've, you know, to have gone through this whole point and not necessarily had to have ask fans for money, or I think one of the other things we do is obviously the live streaming of the games. So when we looked at the live streaming of the games, and a lot of clubs, I hasten to say, I think we were let down by the National League in some form. I think a league-wide streaming solution could have really helped all of the clubs maximise what little income they could do at that time. But that wasn't forthcoming, and we had to investigate our own way of doing it. We had loads of different solutions, and you know, we could buy some equipment. But our chairman was really keen to, this was a real moment to showcase that we want to do the right thing, and we spend a good number of thousands of pounds a game to stream our football games to fans with 4 camera angles, HD, highlights, replays, commentary. We really are one, you know, we certainly feel we're the best in our league at that. But we're certainly, and we've seen it from opposition fans saying how good the stream is and stuff like that. A lot of clubs have sold their season tickets and then sort of used that as a, you know, semi compensation slash, you know, we don't need to give you a refund. We're sort of giving you what you wanted, but it's not what they want. They want to be at the ground. They want to be with you. They want to be with the players in the bar afterwards. They want what we used to. So I think
above anything else as well, that in consumer law, it's illegal, I think.
There's plenty of stuff going on at the moment this season that's probably illegal in some shape or form. But again, yeah. I think even down to something like the live streaming, I really hope that we've shown our values and have shown we've attempted to do the best thing possible by our fans. And it's awful that our fans have to be sat on the other end of a laptop screen or a TV screen to be watching the football. But the fact that's the only option, and the fact that we feel we've gone above and beyond and tried to find the best solution possible to make that happen.
And you think, though, in that context, you think that because of that, because of they know what they're missing, because of the way that the grounds facility development has gone so well, because of the different food options you've got there, because it's such an easy place to get to, you know, that you probably have, you know, some confidence and in them coming back. And I just want to, at this point, you know, as a kind of an additional feature, some things that people might not know about Bromley FC. I mean, to start with, anybody who doesn't know the club will discover that they play, obviously, in white and black. But that also translates to the nicknames. They're known as both the Lily Whites and by contrast, the Ravens. So, that's quite an interesting one. I don't know whether you change it depending on the mood of the people. When things are going well with the Lily Whites, you know, but things are looking dark and brooding, then we become the Ravens. But
definitely a bone of contention amongst the fans. But
but then you've got the problem that they have in the West Country, where Swindon, Cheltenham and Bristol are all called the Robins. You know, so at least...
Very true, yeah.
At least you're different. And the other thing that people might not know, and those... who, if we were actually doing this as a video podcast, would see an enormous pile of records and CDs behind me. But as anyone knows, David Bowie is originally from Bromley, moved to Brixton when he was a little older. And back in 1966, he actually did appear at the ground. He actually crowned 8 May Queens at Bromley Football Club. So back at Hayes Lane in 1966, while England were winning the World Cup, Bromley were actually going a step further. And the god of art, music, pop and possibility was actually there doing his thing. Are there any other Bowie connections that we don't know about?
I'm sure there probably are. I must admit, we've got that photo in our office, which is we're reminded of it regularly. I'm sure there's some supporters that would be better placed to share some other connections. But no, that's certainly our main one.
it's a pretty cool one. So going forward, you know, Darren and I are talking to lots of leagues and lots of clubs in a context of massive uncertainty. If you were going to put a pound on the most likely period when fans might come back in substantial numbers, you know, what is it, and what are you kind of subconsciously hoping and planning for?
I think we fear potentially the last quarter of the year. I think that's our, I hope that's our worst case fear. Mm-hmm. I think there's another announcement in the next couple of weeks, isn't there? We want to be able, just as a club as a whole, the match days are certainly a massive thing, but there are so many other elements that you just want to slowly start helping both the players, our staff, the community make those slow steps back to normal, whether that's the return to outdoor sport, you know, and the soccer schools and the ability of kids being able to play in a structured session and provide coaching again. You know, hopefully, we're hopeful that's one of the first obstacles that we can overcome, one of the first returns to normality that we can have. And again, we just don't know. We don't even know if this season's going to end at the moment in the National League. So, well, I think the chairman's always reminded us all that we've got to look ahead and look to next season. And everything that we do now, like I've said, with the streaming, trying to do the right thing, has all been geared towards making sure when we do have a return, and let's hope it is as close to normal as possible for the new season, for example, that we're in a good place and we're ready to hit the ground running. But I know, I think you've had guests on here previously from other clubs, I think that trend of, I think for the last 10, 12 years, our average attendance has rose every year, other than apart from one possibly, and we were over the 2,000 mark last year. I think we will see that drop potentially. I think there is a risk of, not a risk, sorry, but people, you know, how are people going to respond to being in large crowds again? You know, we do have a 5,000 capacity, but we are, half our ground is still very much old traditional, hasn't changed in decades, and is very tight in areas. So we're going to have a lot. One of our jobs certainly is going to be making sure that match day experience is as safe for people as possible, and doing our utmost to communicate that ahead of any kind of return, which I think we tried to do quite well back in December when we did have those two games with fans. But even then, we were allowed, you know, 1,000 supporters, and we didn't sell out those two games. We did have a great response, but we didn't sell out. So, it's certainly not an easy thing to predict and try and plan and gauge for, but you know, we're certainly hopeful that we can get back to some kind of normality for the new season, whatever that may be.
Yeah, just one final question then, and just get aside from the pandemic, I guess, and trying to look ahead. And you mentioned next season, but I remember we had a conversation probably about 3 years ago now in Manchester, and you were saying, you know, how, if I remember the conversation correctly, how, you know, the National League, especially with the way the playoff system works now, you can almost, you know, a good run of games and suddenly you can be in the playoffs and before you know it in the EFL, as some clubs have found. And you're sitting pretty handily at the moment in 11th, a few games in hand as well. So is that a realistic option, and is that something you still think could happen?
I sure hope so. I'm sure that's what Neil and the chairman have always, that's the ultimate ambition. We continue every year with that in aim. And I fast forward to last season, we probably could have done with them calling the season off probably six weeks before. We might have stuck in the playoffs, but at the moment, like I say, I think we've strengthened in places. You know, we have tried to take advantage where we can. We've signed players. We have strengthened our squad. So for Neil and the chairman, they're certainly. Looking at every week as it comes and trying to maximise where we find ourselves at the moment. Like you say, there will be two clubs, potentially, we still don't know how this is all going to pan out, but there are going to be two clubs that could still end up in the EFL at the end of this season. And, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be up there and be amongst them. I think that's always our ultimate goal throughout all of it. But most importantly, for just like every other club, is the fact that there's still going to be a club there at the end of this season. You know, we're going to be financially as sound as we can be, given the losses incurred over the last 12 months or so. But that's the ultimate goal. But can you rule out the playoffs and the EFL? Certainly not.
Yeah, well, it's a fantastic story. I mean, you know, I think you know how fond we are of you and the club, and you know what you've done and how you've changed that kind of you know, how you've taken that invitation from your brother to go down there, have a game of pool, you know, to a club that's now, you know, looked at with envy, I have to say, from lots of other clubs. So, I mean, Jeff, take care. Hope you're in good health. Darren and I wish you the very best for the rest of the season. Thanks for being our guest today. Thanks again, Darren, for being with us. No doubt there'll be more adventures for Sunderland, Walsall, and obviously our producers, beloved Bradford City, over the next few weeks. But let's privately hope that Bromley do make the leap up to the EFL, so we can hear more about their adventures. So that's it for another episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FanExperienceCo, at Instagram at FanExperience.co, and also via our website at www.FanExperienceCo.com. Remember, by searching for The Fan Experience Experience, you can hear now more than 20 podcast episodes stretching back to April last year, with lots and lots of interesting practitioners from Europe and even further afield. So stay safe, everyone. Stay positive, stay sanitized, and we'll see you next time.
The Fan Experience Experience was recorded live. See you next time.